Chapter 18. As Aryans in Warsaw. According to our plans, we were to go and live in groups of two in Warsaw. None of us knew the addresses of the others. Only Moshke and his friend from Warsaw knew all of them, and they were to act as contacts for us all. This measure was necessary for safety, and it had its advantages, but also disadvantages. The day of our departure for Warsaw with forged papers was approaching. I was not afraid, but my conscience did not let me rest. I did not want to save my life only, but also that of the small child for whom I was responsible. It was not easy for me to leave her, but there was no way to take her along. Staying in Rajin would have meant death for both of us. Such a decision could drive a person insane. Finally, I clung to the thought, it was probably an excuse, of rescuing Sarala by leaving her with a Polish family of the underground when I had established connections. With time, she might forget the past and me as well. Everything revolved around survival only, for both of us. My partner in hiding was to be Moshe Akhareisen. He was about 5 years older than I. We belonged to the same Zionist organization, and he had been a friend of my sister, Sonia. Shortly before the war, he was drafted and managed to return safely. His 3 or 4 brothers had escaped to Russia, and his mother had been killed in an aktion. She was wealthy and had many friends among the Polish farmers, to whom she had given everything she owned for safekeeping. When her son returned, he could not reclaim his mother's possessions, since he knew no details about them. Hence he was left on his own to fight things through. He lived with us until day X. One evening in November, or early December of 1942, I locked the door to the hut, threw away the key and the armband with the Judenstern, and realized that I would never return to Rodzin. I said goodbye to no one. Moshe and I dressed as Aryans in high boots, riding pants, a short winter jacket, a hat with a feather, and carrying a small suitcase. We took the side roads for 6 to 8 kilometers to the village of Pludi. We stayed there for several days in the half-finished part of a wooden house. It belonged to a farm woman who was a friend of the Akhareisen family. The house was not heated, and it was terribly cold. Winds blew through the chinks in the wooden walls. Everything in the room, including the beds and the bedding, belonged to the Akhareisen family. We were able to cover ourselves enough to prevent our freezing to death, and we were happy to have a roof over our heads. 2 days later, our officer's wife from Danzig visited us from Beldendal. Elegant and handsome, she instilled confidence with her friendly appearance. According to my new Aryan identification card, with photo and signature, my name from them on was Jan Wozniak. My birth certificate and work permit bore the same name. We would repeat our new names and other vital information again and again, so as not to make any mistakes. After discussing the final details and security measures, we set the date for our departure to Warsaw. Because of the darkness, we chose a train that left Brno between 9 and 10 p.m. and arrived in Warsaw early the next morning. It was about 3 kilometers from our lodging in Brno to the somewhat remote train station. At the prearranged time, we met our female companion, who gave us our train tickets. Despite the late departure, we passed several suspicious people who made us feel uneasy. As we boarded the train, we hurdled the first obstacle. The train was not full. For security reasons, we tried to change cars. Gendarmes, Polish police, and train inspectors walked relentlessly through the train. They repeatedly checked individual passengers and arrested some. All of these people were Jews for whom there was no longer any hope of rescue. I recognized some from Rajin in the train. Chancia Wolf, her brother and brother-in-law, Uziel Weissmann, and some others. We exchanged glances without talking, but somehow understanding each other. I was talking with our guide, the officer's pretty wife, in whom I placed all my hope. My thoughts wandered to my abandoned child and my chevra, some of whom were already in Warsaw, and others who still had a long road ahead of them. Then I thought of all those who, unlike us, could not fight for their lives, and who therefore had to accept the death which the Nazis prescribed. Hours of tension and uncertainty somehow always last infinitely long. In vain I tried to sleep, leaning on the officer's wife in order to hide my face. With closed eyes, I saw and heard everything. We finally arrived in Warsaw. We left the train at Wileński station. At the exit, innumerable German and Polish men in uniform and secret agents with their well-known leather coats, upright collars, and hats pulled over their faces were standing in line. Their keen eyes scrutinized every arriving passenger. All of them were looking for the same commodity, Jewish blood. Our companion took our arms, and after a few moments of terror, we knew that we had succeeded. Half an hour later, we were with the mother of the Polish girl photographer from Rosin, who had given us the address, a poor, benevolent woman living alone. At her apartment, I also met her son, who would later play such a tragic role. They lived in a small apartment on the ground floor in the back of the building. It would have been impossible to stay there. During the day, it was dangerous because of the neighbors, who, through the doors and windows, could see everything. The place was crawling with informers. We lay down on the floor, the officer's wife between us, and waited for darkness. If I kissed her, I do not remember now, then it was only out of sheer gratitude. Our friend Gellerman was already in Warsaw and had found accommodations for the two people in each group through his connections in the underground. That evening our guide brought us to the new quarters where we said goodbye to that courageous and beautiful woman. We embraced and I kissed her in the hope of seeing her again, but we never met again. Everything had gone well so far. The feeling of being with decent Poles made us extremely happy. One should never lose faith in one's fellow man. The big jump succeeded, but the struggle for survival continued. Our accommodations in Warsaw were located in Praga, Rajminska 52, on the third floor of the Czeslaw Kidzinski family. He was a former circus acrobat who worked under the artistic name of Duo Alcaro, but at that time he was working for the railroad. Although both he and his wife, a cabaret dancer, were active in the underground, we never discussed their involvement, nor did we talk about Jews. Our room was furnished with two beds, two chairs, one small table. It had two windows with the curtains always drawn. A picture on the wall showed a circus act with Duo Alcaro. We occasionally left the apartment at night to get a breath of fresh air. We always went out separately and very carefully, so as not to be seen by the neighbors or the janitor. We were like two birds in a cage, waiting to hear from friends and longing for our chevra and freedom. After several days, our contact, Moshe Gellerman, came to see us. We were happy to hear that all the chevra had managed to arrive safely in Warsaw. Gellerman reported that our connections with both the Polish underground and with the Jewish Zionist youth organization, Hashomer Hatzair, had been re-established. He also mentioned that the Osterman problem had been settled. We heard there, for the first time, that a problem Osterman had existed. Our friend Osterman from Mijerich belonged to our organization and had connections with the headquarters in Warsaw. During our time with Hashomer Hatzair, he had come to us and asked us to organize a resistance group. We did not succeed since we were constantly exposed to persecution and Aktionen. Sometime later, while the Gellerman brothers were still in Suchowola, Schulz, the notorious SS man, organized another Aktion, a Mijerich. Without saying or asking anything, he went to Osterman's apartment and shot him on the spot. This murder caused excitement and suspicion in our Warsaw headquarters. How could such a thing happen with the good relationship which existed between the Gellermans and Schulz? Why did Schulz go to Osterman of all people? Moshke had been suspected of complicity. Now it seems that he had been able to clarify the matter. To this day, I don't know the details. Since none of my friends survived, I never found out anything more about this incident. There was so much hysteria then that this episode could have happened because of carelessness, or perhaps it was just bad luck. I am sure, however, and will remain convinced until I die, that all the Chevra members, and especially the Gellerman brothers, were loyal friends, especially as they were fellow Jews and Zionists. They lived as such they probably lost their lives in the Warsaw Ghetto Revolt. All honor to their memory. During one of his next visits, Moshke told me how he had been recognized by the so-called Schmaltzovniks. They were Poles who specialized in finding Jews to extort or turn them over to the Gestapo. They recognized him as a Jew, and when he denied it, they dragged him into an alley where he was forced to pull down his pants. He was, however, able to redeem himself with 10,000 zloty. This was our life in Warsaw. Our expenditures increased constantly. We had to pay for lodging and everything else. The Kidzinskis were very decent Poles, but they were not purely idealistic. Nor could we expect them to be. They were too poor for that. Moshke and I paid a sum that would have been enough for all. Our money reserves should have lasted for a long time. Life with the Kaczynskis would have been easy if there had been no alcohol, and if our two Poles had not been so addicted to it. Every evening at 6, when Czesław returned from work, the first liter bottle of real or homemade vodka was opened, and by 10 o'clock it was empty. A new bottle was opened when his wife came home. Everyone drank from glasses. I cannot remember ever having seen an unfinished bottle there. In retrospect, I have to laugh about the first time I gulped down a glass of homemade Bimber vodka. It robbed me of speech and breath. Only by raising my arms and being pounded on the back did I recover. We had to participate so as not to spoil their fun. After all, we depended on their mercy. When Cheslav's wife came home from the cabaret at 10 o'clock, everything started over again. But this time there were four of us. As soon as we all got drunk and our inhibitions disappeared, the not exactly shy woman often began showing her feelings towards us, to which Cheslav reacted with a show of real or feigned jealousy. Of course, neither my friend nor I forgot our situation for a single moment. During the high points of such bimber evenings, one had to be very cautious, since the danger of a confrontation grew steadily. Drunken people, particularly Poles, can be unpredictable. Polish drinking parties often end in fights, even among the best of friends. Fortunately, this never happened for as long as I stayed there. How should all this continue? Always the same question. We could not even think about the end of the war. In the underground, ideas circulated about the possibility of reaching Palestine by fleeing to Romania and from there to Turkey. But that called for money, lots of it. Nevertheless, people in our situation were enthusiastic about the idea. Our greatest asset was our access to stolen identification papers. People in the ghettos would have given anything to get these papers. To combine practicality and usefulness could mean our salvation. I discussed this plan with my friend Moshka, and immediately saw the chance that I could perhaps rescue my child this way. Full of enthusiasm, I volunteered to take forged Aryan identification cards into the ghetto and Mijijek. This undertaking could be daring and risky, but if it succeeded, my life would have meaning again, and my Hevra and my child, whom I loved more than anything in the world, would be helped. It was the beginning of 1943. The news of the war was encouraging. That from the ghettos, discouraging. In the Warsaw ghetto, resistance was stirring. Outside, Jews in hiding were savagely hunted. Through Moshka, we heard about everything that happened in the ghetto, including the preparations for the rebellion. Everything now depended on the success of my journey to the Mijijek ghetto with fake passes. After my return, something would have to happen. If the trip was successful, then we hoped at least to be in a financial position to fulfill our dream of fleeing to Palestine. The alternative was to join the partisan movement, but even for that one needed money. If I failed, only the ghetto and an anonymous failure remained. Holding out with Aryan papers was becoming increasingly difficult and almost hopeless. Seen from that angle, we all knew we had nothing to lose. We were actually gambling with lives that had already been lost. So we made all the necessary preparations. My escort was to be the brother of our Polish friend, the woman photographer from Radzin. Of course, he had been well paid. Neither Cheslav or his wife or my Polish companion knew my real name. Even I had forgotten it. I was Jan Wozniak.